I'm Mohawk Matt, and this is By Hair, Land, and Sea, where we will bridge the gap and have conversations that need to happen. After spending 13 years, both as an active duty Marine and then a Navy civilian, I am now on a mission to serve our nation by providing a megaphone for the right people at the right time. Join me and my guest as we remove barriers so that you can do what you do best. Be awesome. See you in the trenches. What's going on, everyone? Welcome to Hair, Land, and Sea, where today we have got Jason Knutson. He's the CEO of Visva Lab, and we're going to have an awesome conversation about innovation across the defense space. So defense innovation, which is the DoD, Department of Defense, where it's been, what's going on now, where it's going, the different generations of it, and what he calls the third generation that's coming now. And also, what is innovation to him? He recently published a paper on OTAs, which is other transaction authorities, which is a big part of the innovation contract space. He was recently selected as one of the 2022 Fed 100, which is a great honor. So join me and welcome Jason. What's up, Jason?
Hey, Matt. Awesome to be on your podcast. Love the title of the podcast. So I'm really on here because the pun got to me, and I'm looking forward to the conversation, man.
Fantastic. Yeah, we just had to riff off it. We know that the podcast goal is being a part of the whole government atmosphere. And so Hair, Land, and Sea just came to us.
How does it feel to have your entire personality defined by your hairstyle?
So when it first started happening, my wife turns to me and says, "You're never cutting your hair anymore, are you?" I was like, "Nope." The Mohawk just became part of everything. It's on my board behind me. You can see it's just embodied everything that happens.
Maybe after we have this conversation, we should turn around and I can interview you on the Mohawk thing. That'd be a lot of fun. We'll have a Mohawk Matt takeover.
Let's do it. I like that because most of the time, people think I talk about myself, but I really don't. I do on other shows. So let's party.
So it's all about making other people awesome, which is amazing.
That's the way to go. So folks, I'm super excited for this conversation. Jason Knutson, he's the CEO of Visva Lab. He's been around the innovation and defense innovation space for years. He's got a long history of work in defense innovation. He's recently published a paper on OTAs, other transaction authority, on the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And he co-wrote that paper with Stan Soloway, who's the former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Reform. And that paper and their awesome acts across the defense innovation space has gotten both of them recently selected for the 2022 Fed 100. So congrats on that. That's fantastic.
Thanks, Matt. There's just read through that 100 group of people and you're just instantly humbled to be included in that group.
Oh, definitely. And you're one of them. That's why you're here. So Jason, you've been around. How did you fall into this innovation world?
Yeah. So I guess like a little bit of intro to me, I spent 20 years in the Navy, 10 years enlisted, 10 years officer. I did everything from being an enlisted cryptologist to doing special warfare as a special warfare combatant crewman, jumping out of planes. I got a physics degree at University of Colorado with a philosophy degree, worked at NIST, commissioned a submarine officer, did SSBNs, SSGNs. Then I went over to do back into cryptologic warfare, SIG and Cyber EW, had tours with counterterrorism, tours in the Pentagon working acquisitions, ended up out 7th Fleet as the first innovation officer out there, and ended up my entire time at the Defense Innovation Unit. And so I think I attribute my entry into innovation with the fact I really couldn't hold a job down for very long in the Navy. And I joke about that, but I treat that as a feature. So I had the ability to really take a look at a lot of different perspectives in the military and seeing a lot of things that I wanted to change. And I ended up having a lot of mentors. The most significant collaborations I've had is with Captain Sean Heritage, who ended up being the interim director of DIU towards the end of his career in the Navy. He still has a career and really being surrounded by it. But my first formal job was as the deputy director of the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, where I got to work my own projects and work for the CNO to deliver innovation into the Navy with a very small group of people.
And I love that story. Let's pull back just a little bit on, for those that may not be as familiar, or innovation's about, like, there might be people that are already taking shots. Every time we say innovation, they might be throwing one back. Coffee or alcohol, your choice. But so to you, what is innovation?
Yeah. So got a couple of different contexts here, right? Anybody you talk to and say innovation, you get one of two things. Like innovation, I don't really know what it is, but I know when I see it. Or innovation, I hate that term. We need to pick something else. I'd rather have agility or just call it new stuff or whatever. So I actually did a study while I was in the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell and looked at over 300 different definitions. And I came up with a definition of my own that was a consolidation of those. And it's innovation is a new concept, idea, process, or thing that creates change and delivers value. And a couple of years ago, I was at Montgomery, at the Montgomery IT Symposium. I was giving a keynote, and a guy named Dan Ward, who is a Air Force acquisition, former Lieutenant Colonel, gave a presentation before me, and he stands up and he puts his definition of innovation up there. And I was like, man, that's so much better than mine. And he says, I looked at a whole bunch of definitions of innovation, and he said, I wasn't going to improve or wordsmith it. So what I did was I just basically said, hey, what's the litmus test? And it says, any definition of innovation has to have two things, a statement of novelty and a statement of impact. And what I'd say is when you're looking for innovation, you're looking for new things that create some kind of impact. And we can argue about what the novelty is. Is it things? Is it processes? Or what the impact is, that the creation of change? Is it the creation of value? How we do that. But if we apply that litmus test, when somebody comes up and says, hey, I've got something that's innovative, we can actually make determinations and make innovation useful again. I think the problem with the term innovation right now is it's overused. It's not well-defined. And so it's not useful. Just real quick on that though, let's play that out. If innovation is novelty plus impact, what is innovation without impact, without value? Then that's just novelty. And so what is the creation of new things? That's invention. That's basic research. When you go talk to a researcher at a university and they'll tell you, I purposely do not consider the value because basic research is about, you know, pursuing the problem where it goes. And from there, we'll discover value. Other people will take what we've done and create value. But there's a valuable thing in just creating novel things. And so I don't want innovation to replace like invention.
No.
That's messed up. And a lot of people just talk about innovation as new things. What about the opposite thing? What if it's not new, but it creates a lot of value? I call this the cereal box example, right? Hey, we got this innovative new cereal, right? Four new fruit flavors. That's awesome, but that's not innovation because that is just creating value. And so when you have something that has value, but is not novel, that's the core business line product, right? That's awesome. That's what almost every single business is out there doing. They take something that has been invented and take that value and put it into the market, but that's not innovation. And so if you go back and somebody says my cereal box is innovative, or they say, hey, I've got a new kind of beer helmet and it really improves. It's got the spiral ones, right? That's an invention, but not doesn't necessarily bring a significant amount of value. And again, not innovation, but there you go. That was probably a longer answer than you were seeking.
No, I like that. I like that perspective. And there's a piece in there you talked to. It's such a cluttered understanding in the word because everyone does have a different definition for it or understanding of what it is, or they just don't understand. Oftentimes you hear in large organizations, like, oh yeah, just give me some of that innovation. Like I've got my innovation water bottle right here.
Yeah, it's innovation.
Just drink some innovation and you're good to go. That's all it takes.
Yeah. And then you've got these innovation pipelines, right? And so when you build an innovation pipeline, you go talk to some of these research organizations and they're like, how many companies can I flow through the pipeline? And what kind of technology do I get out the back end?
Yeah.
And that is really, they're looking at that value proposition. They're looking at just what technological invention can I pull through? When you look at the value creation piece, you start getting into some of the business processes, like the organizational design. Is the organization set up to be able to receive those new technological innovations? Because that's where the value creation comes. We often see that some of these new innovations come in and the organization's not ready for it. I was just talking to a communications squadron and they're saying that we have resistance to adopting all these new things because we have a globally distributed infrastructure. And if I bring the new thing into the globally distributed infrastructure, I break that infrastructure and all of the things that are dependent upon that break down. Just because I write in something novel does not mean I actually create value for the organization. And I need to, if I want to do invention, I need to find a way to bring novel things in a way that create value. And so that's really what this innovation thing's about. And that's why innovation is hard. It's the transition between the invention space and the business space. It's that transition between making stuff and selling stuff. And so you actually have to have some aspects of both an inventor and an entrepreneur in order to do innovation.
How would you blend? So a lot of people think that innovation is just technology. And it's just, give us a new tool and it'll solve all the problems and now we're innovated. But I know you've got background. It's a lot of that cultural blend. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I break down that whenever I consider something in a process, and this is systems engineering, is you have the thing that you're bringing in, technology, new concepts, whatever. You have your psychosocial, right? What are the norms and behaviors of the people in dealing with this new thing? And then you have your psychological. What's the individual's impact on this? And a lot of people don't consider that, right? The military is not good at using squishy terms like feeling words. How does this missile make you feel? But at the end of the day, you go talk to your Marine that just got a new missile system on the weapons, and they're going to use feeling words, right? They're going to be like, this thing is badass. Makes me feel powerful to do this. Or this thing sucks. It just frustrates me. I wish we had the other thing. Those words really indicate that we're not meeting the innovation value on its other chains. So your question was, is it just technological? No, it's technology. It's process. It really goes back to creating value, right? And if you're just focusing on the technology, you're just focusing on novelty. What you really need to do is focus on creating that impact when you're talking about new things and creating those value chains. And when you do that, then you have to consider process. In fact, process often leads technological innovation. Technology is really the automation of process in many things. Think about an automobile, right? The automobile is just the automation of stepping. Like those cylinders going up and down in the motor is literally like, It converts chemical energy and forward energy, which is the same thing you do when you're marching with a backpack on. So literally, it's just a more efficient way of doing it. But the process remains the same, right? The process and the need. And so what we're doing is we're using technology to solve for process and needs to create that value.
I like that. As you've been around I like the simplicity of that example of the car, because it really is the process. It gets so lost. You may know a lot of people have heard me use the term bureaucracy slayer. And that was a name that I got years ago for doing old day procurement. Different story, different podcast. But a lot of people misunderstand that. And they think that it's just like, all I want to do is like break in and destroy the process. And that's the complete opposite. It's an understanding of what the process is. And does it need to be that? Sometimes it does. And if it does, how do we modify it to make it more efficient? I love the example you use, because the process often gets thrown out the window of like, oh, in order to innovate, we just got to get rid of the process. Well, actually, you need that first, and then you blend that together, like you said, that car example. I want to pivot to, we've talked before about the three generations of it, of the innovation groups and sales that have been occurring. Can you talk to that?
Yeah. So when I was doing the research for that OTA paper, there's a section in the OTA paper of like, why now? And what's been going on? Why is there all this innovation? Why in 2016 did the OTA get additional plus up from Congress and additional authorities to go to production? Why are we doing all this? And it's really in the context of this emergence of great power competition, reemergence of Russia, obviously, with the Ukraine going on right now, the emergence of China, and with the Ukraine situation, got to be watching Taiwan as well. And back in 2012, 2013, 2014, you have folks like Bob Work, who's working several different senior level positions in the Department of Defense, eventually was the Undersecretary of Defense under Secretary Carter. He and Secretary Carter were working on this thing called the third offset. First offset being nuclear weapons, second offset being stealth and precision munitions. So you got Tomahawk, you got F-16. Well, you've got all the F series all the way up to the 18. F-22 and F-35 came in the 1980s after that, but same concept. And then the third offset was really a cluster of technologies. If you look at the way the departments picked it up, like artificial intelligence, autonomy, directed energy weapons, hypersonics, that was a list of technologies. But at the end of the day, it really was innovation. How do we get the novel things to the warfighter in a more efficient way? So it's really, how do you stay ahead of the adversary who had the ability to observe and modify their behaviors towards your actions faster? And so the first generation of defense innovation in the third offset was really these disruptive innovation groups. Groups like the Strategic Capabilities Office that was initially led by Dr. Roper, who then became the head of acquisition for the Air Force. You had organizations like some of these early OTA consortia, including NSTXL. You had the CIA had their InQtel, which is their investment group that's out in Silicon Valley. You had my groups like the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell. You had the emergence of Defense Entrepreneurs Forum off of Ben Coleman, who wrote The Military Needs More Disruptive Thinkers, which really kicked off this grassroots movement. Both of those came from DEF, and CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell came from that. You had the emergence of the Navy Innovation Advisor Council and the NIAC Fellows, and the establishment of the Navy Innovation Network, which was a chartered organization that basically provided top government support for innovators at a grassroots level at the Secretary of the Navy's level. That first phase culminated with the establishment of the Defense Innovation Unit, which has a connection to the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell. It has a connection to groups like Air Force groups at the Hoover Institute out in Silicon Valley, has a connection to a group called the Cyber Reserve Element, the CREE, under U.S. Cybercom. And the establishment of the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, DIU, really was created by a bunch of these groups coming together. You had inputs by the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, Josh Steinman. You had inputs via the Hoover Institute that had people like Colonel Enrique Odi. You had groups out there, Cyber Reserve Element, that was on Moffett Field, which was actually a cybercom innovation organization. And all those concepts came together in one spot, which was a briefing with, I mentioned Captain Sean Heritage before. He was the executive assistant to the commander of U.S. Cybercom, Admiral Rogers. Deputy Secretary of Defense Work came out with his group and was getting briefings on Cybercom and all those efforts. And Admiral Rogers turned to Captain Heritage and said, "Hey, we got some time. You want to show them this like Silicon Valley beachhead type activity," which was really a combination of the stuff of observe and report and engage and you'll get part of the money ecosystem in Silicon Valley. And like the Cyber Reserve Element was like, but let's do this in many different innovation areas. So that got picked up, but all these early stage first generation projects were very disruptive. They were small, they were not well funded, and they were largely at risk of going away based upon just not having the institutional support and being a small fish in a big bureaucracy.
Yeah, no, it's really, I love that history of where it all started, or at least in that third offset where it started, of those groups coming together, then became a DIU, then became these other things. So that's the first of the third offset. So now let's go to the second and then the third.
Yeah. So the second generation is sort of scaling of it. This is where these innovation organizations started getting some sponsorship. They started getting large amounts of money, but they still were not in the core of the organization. And if you wanted to put a name on it, I call it the works generation. This is where everything got titled with the works. This is Air Force CyberWorks. This is like the epitome of this was AFWorks. And there's an organization down in Florida. Before AFWorks, there was SoftWorks, and DefenseWorks has several of these different works. There's other organizations that stood up, Air Force's Spark Cells. This is really dominated by the Air Force's effort. The Navy at the time had made a decision to shift into high velocity learning and agility. And we talked about the definition of innovation, had abandoned innovation, really killed the SSG and the CRIC, and had really reinvested in Office of Naval Research. And Office of Naval Research was running some great programs. However, the Air Force took a lot of the concepts that were built in the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, the NIAC, and took the DEF concepts. Like spark cells were actually originally Athena project, which they came over and talked to NIAC. It was co-located at DIU, some of the founders of the spark cells, and that the spark cells turned into AFWERX. And they're like, hey, what do you do? Hey, we have this idea of these distributed Athena projects where there's like pitch competitions, right? There was definitely a seed there of naval innovation that moved into Air Force innovation, not to take anything from the Air Force that went out and executed this and actually put money behind it. Again, second generation, putting money behind these projects. And then really the capstone of that was when the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, Chief Master Sergeant Wright, stood up in front of a whole bunch of airmen and declared war in the frozen middle and started talking about emotionally, right? We can't let the frozen middle keep us from achieving the things that we want to do. We can't be frustrated from this. And the Chief of Staff of the Air Force came back. And that was the first time that really the organizational cultural aspects of innovation were gone after. Before, like the core of the organizations throughout DOD and the greater interagency were focused on this technological innovation. And it was just these like small cells that were building community, building the virtuous insurgency, having conversations about what the human capital needs to be. And so that's really the end of the second generation. And it's really scaling. And at the end of the day, you had things like AFWERX, that's the dominant one. And with their core sponsor, who was Dr. Roper, who had become the head of acquisitions for the Air Force. But those were largely dependent upon the sponsorship of those senior people to be sustained.
I think people know my background with NavalX. Is that in that second generation?
Absolutely. So the Navy also killed the Navy Innovation Advisor Council.
Yeah.
You also have your lead blocker, right? Who is your sponsor, your top government support, personality dependent, Hondo Gertz.
Yep.
So Hondo is actually the progenitor of the works movement, right? You might actually say it wasn't Roper who kicked this off. It was Hondo, when he was the head of acquisitions for SOCOM, stood up SOFWERX. And SOFWERX was the first of these really works organizations. So after they killed NIAC at the Secretary of Navy level, the Navy decided they're going to stand up another innovation organization. And they decided to stand it up in the Secretary of Navy's office through the Office of Naval Research. And there's plenty of reasons why NavalX is not executing like acquisition scale stuff like AFWERX is doing. One of that is like the Secretary of the Navy level is really policy and influence versus actual acquisitions. And the contracts that NavalX are instituting are through the traditional ONR space. So if you look at it from technological innovation, ONR really only has access to research development and prototyping money. And it doesn't really, you kind of miss that gap that DIU is going after with production OTAs, and which is the ability to scale innovation. And so you end up in the same valley of death that all of ONR's problems have. And this is not me like beating up on ONR, fantastic people, fantastic program. Like, I think the greatest thing that NavalX has done is pushing innovation out to the edges with the tech bridges, which looks a lot like spark tanks. The key difference between the Navy's approach and we talked Department of Navy, I think even the Marine Corps is ahead with the establishment of the Marine Innovation Unit, which is going to talk about this third generation innovation organizations. But the Navy has gone all in on technological innovation. The Air Force is probably 6 to 8 years ahead of the Navy at this point and has true innovation velocity. The true like high velocity learning is going on the Air Force because of those conversations that senior leaders in the Air Force had about going after the cultural aspects.
And that's the beauty about the spark cells is the sparks. That's the big difference between like tech bridges and the spark tank or spark cells is the tech bridges are rooted in the warfare center research model of the Navy, where the spark cells are rooted at the actual in the Navy we would call fleet level, and they're actually on operational bases.
Yep.
And I've been to Spark Cell when they said, all right, airmen, go to the flight line and find a problem. And they would go to the real fleet and they'd go to the real warfighter instead of just prototyping in a research space.
And you can't build requirements for the things that these Spark Cells are going after. So I just got done with the Rocky Mountain Space Symposium, Air Force and Space Force. So Space Force is Department of the Air Force. It's not only is it taking advantage of all the cultural awesomeness that's going on in the Air Force, but they are, because they're a new startup, they are pushing the limits. They're actually pushing outside of the bounds of the Air Force. And the Air Force is now like trying to hold the reins back on them. Like, what are you doing? But I think there's two things in regards to tech prisons versus Spark Cells. One is that the Spark Cells really bring you, get you an agile thing because it's user focused, right? Mm-hmm. It's at the operational commands. When an operation lead is there, like the Spark Cell has like 150K per year to go just execute on that. You don't have to go through a requirements process. You don't have to work with a, you know, work with the Pentagon and get it resourced. You've been resourced to do innovation activities, right? I think innovation is an operational function, right? It's not an acquisition function. It's actually bringing requirements creation and execution together to create these prototypes. So I'll give you an example. Just talked to a general who was in charge of Cape Canaveral, and he was telling, he's got a Spark Cell down there. It's actually the first Space Force Spark tank or Spark Cell is at Cape Canaveral with all the launch facilities. And his Spark Cell came up and they solved the problem on their base through their emergency services department. You're not going to get emergency services going to pop up on ONR scale, right? Their emergency services said, hey, we need to know when an AED is used, right? The defibrillator, like somebody has a heart attack, you pull that off the wall, go hit it. So what they did is they just put a cable on that. And when that cable gets pulled, it automatically sends a signal to the firehouse and to the emergency services. You don't have to call 911 anymore. They just respond. And that was executed via a Spark Cell talking to a local base for a local need and executed. I've got a lot of faith in the organization of the Navy and the tech bridges, but because of the way it's organized, how it's structured, it's just not responsive to those types of things. It's responsive to centrally controlled ideas that come from the Secretary of Navy's level, which is not like local base stuff.
Sure. So I want to keep that thread going of, have we talked about the third generation?
No, we haven't talked about the third generation. I'll keep it short because I know we're running on time and happy to come back and deep dive with these. So third organization, what happened is we had a change of administration and a lot of these sponsors, a lot of top government support went away. Dr. Roper, Hondo Gertz departed. And so these organizations that their senior sponsors had largely taken budgets from other places and we're protecting, especially the second generation like AFWERX, which were running, basically had taken all of the SBIR money from AFRL of all the other organizations that were running it through there, massive operations. Those organizations started going, yeah, but we really can do this, and started pulling back that money. And what you also saw is innovation. When we talk about innovation and bureaucracy, I've learned a great respect for the bureaucracy. Because bureaucracy is in place to take complex things that once we found a product, once we've moved into that, out of the novelty space and into the value space, it locks you in the core business and makes it repeatable and makes it scalable. The problem with bureaucracy is it's hard to change that because the function of bureaucracy is to resist change. So the goal for any innovation organization is to transition it into bureaucracy. So the second generation innovation organizations were still disruptive. They're still outside of the main organization. And so what you ended up with from AFWERX is you ended up with a whole bunch of SBIR companies that had executed on their phase two SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research, grants for like $150,000 to $1.5 million. They executed, and then they couldn't get authority to operate on government networks. They couldn't find a core organization to put in a budget request via POM, the budget process, to go and become a program of record and get their SBIR phase three contract, which will allow them to scale. And so you just had a lot of people that were stuck at this they're stuck in the innovation space and they can't transition into the bureaucracy. And so the third generation is really insourcing of innovation into the bureaucracy. And this is taking the lessons learned from these innovation organizations and bringing them in. I'd say it's also the maturation of some of these innovation organizations to be more bureaucratic. And so you look at things like Defense Innovation Unit getting its authority to do its own acquisitions, or all of their OTAs were done with through Army Contract and Command New Jersey. They got authority to do CNAP, Cloud Native Access Point, right? They're starting to get your core bureaucratic organizations. And AFRL is taking back authority and money over a super program. But when it comes back in, they're also doing it in a way that's the way the AFRC said it. They're taking those lessons and learn. And so when you look at third generation organizations, I think the archetypical third generation organization is a place called Callis Campus, which is down in Colorado Springs. And full disclosure, I'm on the board of Callis Campus, and I know you've had some conversations with them as well. They host Platform One. They host Space Camp. They host, the Navy's got a presence there. They've got the Navy's Forge, which is the Navy software factory associated with Aegis. They've got a Callis Campus in Utah, which is associated with strategic missile systems, right? These organizations are inclusive of the existing bureaucracy. And what they're doing is really transitioning that innovation into the bureaucracy and working well. So what you're going to end up with is a full pipeline that's able to go from commercial side through the innovation, through the scaling, and into the bureaucracy. And that's hugely powerful. And so what we want to do, I think, in this third generation, which is just starting, is we really want to make sure that the innovation is preserved into the bureaucracy, which means that the bureaucracy is going to have to change. And this goes back to the biggest danger of the third phase of innovation is exactly what we talked about in the beginning, is that if it's just technological, we're going to fail because of the culture and the individual responses. We need to train the organization in things like design thinking, lean systems, lean startup, agile, in order to create the behaviors, the culture. We need to go out and do like the Air Force did and say, attack the frozen middle and attach this boogeyman frozen middle, all the negative aspects, get to know, devil's advocate, not invented here. All that stuff has to go out the window. And we have to create a new set of values that we as an organization try to get to, right? Experimentation, assisting in the transition. We own the process, right? Ownership of the process. We can change the process. These sort of cultural things, people like us do things like this, are really the architecture that we have to hang our hat on. And if we focus in the third generation on those cultural and individual aspects, the technological innovation will come. And back to our definition, once we start that novelty coming in into an organization that can take that novelty and create value out of it, now we actually have innovation. And in the third generation, we have innovation at scale.
I like it. And we could keep going on for hours and hours. So there will have to be future episodes, but I appreciate your experience throughout the defense innovation, the kind of the culmination of that third offset of the first, second, and third generations of where it's been, what's happening now, and where it's going. As you said, we're just on the very beginning of that third generation of things like Callis Campus and other organizations like that. So really appreciate you sharing your story and sharing all your info, Jason.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm really excited about this format you got, and excited to be one of your first couple of guests, I think.
Yeah, you are. And that's exactly what this is for. This is for the unbiased conversation of just where things are, what's going on, and the right conversation. And I'm going to have other conversations with other people that may have a different definition of innovation. And then eventually we'll come together and do a joint one. And we have the, because that's where the good things come. That's where innovation usually comes from, is the difference of ideas along the time and the colliding conversation.
I think the best aspect of the group that we've got together here and your optimism and driving that, this is how we should approach these things, right? To make them awesome, is that I'm passionate about the space, and I never want to come in and be, hey, I'm being critical for critical sake. I'm being critical because we can do better, and I see a better way. And, you know, I often describe like problems in the military is it's the best people stuck in the worst system. And so we just got to change that system. We got to be like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Stop. I'm not doing this workaround anymore. We're fixing this. And I think that is what the opportunity I think that we see, and the opportunity that I'm excited about having a conversation with you, is just to be able to go out and convince people that the optimism that we own the system, we can fix the system, and we can make it awesome. That sort of steal your catchphrase.
No, that's fantastic. Really appreciate your insight, your experience. You've been around a lot. You've seen it. You've been in the crick. That was the word I was looking for earlier, the in and outs of it all. So again, folks, I hope you learned a lot from Jason. Jason, if folks want to reach out, they want to carry this conversation on with you, jump into things you're doing, how do they get a hold of you?
It's easy. Hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm fairly responsive on that. My email is jason@visvalab.com. Probably easier to just look me up on LinkedIn instead of spell Visa. But yeah, hit me up. If you see me out there, I'm willing to talk to anybody anytime.
Definitely. And if you guys haven't had a chance, go check out his recent paper on OTAs that's on the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Again, that he co-authored with Stan Soloway, and you can see more in depth of what they were talking about there. So everyone, thanks for tuning in once again to By Hair, Land and Sea. And if you're wherever you're watching, listening, throw us some love, throw us a subscribe, a comment, who you want to hear from next, what we can do to make this conversation better for you. Otherwise, Jason, thanks again.
Thanks, Matt.
Yep. See you, everybody.